Love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more? Check out my podcast. Hi, I'm Kadra, the host of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. I tell tales every single week that have left me perplexed. You'll hear true crime cases, mysterious disappearances, learn about cults, hear baffling sightings of cryptids, chilling paranormal encounters, and even dark and weird history. I release new episodes every Wednesday, and you can listen anywhere podcasts are available. I'm also on Patreon, and you can even watch me on YouTube. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. Stories that will leave you perplexed.
Hi, I'm Katie.
And I'm Kelly.
And if you're looking for a super fun, awesome podcast to listen to, check us out.
All things outrageously dark, scary, beautiful, and totally true.
You are listening to Perplexity.
No trail leads to this cabin, not even a blaze on a tree. Hidden beneath the tall dark firs is this cabin of mystery. No one knew its builder, or when this cabin was made. Not one of the oldest trappers can explain or give any aid. The stove still stands in the corner, the table all neat and clean. And the cupboard still holds its grub steak as fine as ever was seen. But there are no traps or stretchers, so no trapper was he. No prospector's pick or shovel, all adds to the mystery. No name up on the door jamb, no initials cut in the wall. No calendar hangs by the window, just silence and mystery, that's all. But the hills hold many a secret that the trails and streams never tell. We can only guess at the answer, and perhaps it's just as well. Now, as I gaze at this cabin, brush almost obscuring the door, many moons have you guarded the secret, keep you guard for as many more. But perhaps when we cross the border and step aboard death's train, the secret of hills and mountains to us will be plain. The Cabin of Mystery by James W. Wilt. On the chilly night of February 24th, 1978, five close-knit friends would pile into their car and go to a basketball game. The men were from Yuba City, California, and on this night, they would vanish. 24-year-old Jackie Charles Hewitt, 29-year-old William or Bill Lee Sterling, 32-year-old Theodore Ted Earl Weir, 30-year-old Jack Doc Antone Madruga, and 25-year-old Gary Dale Mathias would leave a basketball game at a local university in Chico, California. It seemed like a typical fun night for the five friends, who their families lovingly referred to as the boys. But this night would become the anniversary of their nightmare, the day their lives would change forever. No definitive evidence has emerged to conclusively determine what happened on the night of February 24th, 1978. This case continues to baffle investigators and captivate the public's imagination, standing as one of the most perplexing missing persons cases in American history. Over four decades later, the men's fate remains shrouded in mystery, with many questions still left unanswered. In fact, the more I learned about this case, the more confused I became. In the words of the author, Tony Wright, quote, "If you're going to research the Yuba County 5 case, you've got to accept the ache of uncertainty. Not knowing is the hardest part. The realization is that for all the research, the hours of interviews, and the data collected, we will likely never know what happened to those five young men that night. What drove them into the mountains, 70 miles in the wrong direction, amid sub-freezing temperatures, wearing only spring clothes? What then made them abandon the safety of their vehicle and hike further into the wilderness instead of turning around and heading back home? End quote. This is the deep dive into the story of the Yuba County 5 case, also known as the American Dilatov Pass incident or the Matthias Group incident. And you are listening to part 3 of 3. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra, and thank you so much for tuning in. If you are new here, hello and welcome to the show. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And I would love if you follow along if you enjoy. And if you're a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. Happy you're here. Today, we are rounding out this 3-part series, and I hope you guys have been staying with me and enjoying it. If you have, please let me know, because this is the deepest dive I think I've ever done on anything. As you all know, I read a book for this case, and that is Tony Wright's book, and it is called Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five. So I want to, first of all, thank Tony for writing this book, putting it together, because it was incredibly helpful in my research. And I also want to say I am incredibly excited because in this episode, I get to interview none other than Tony Wright. So after I released part 1 of the Yuba County 5 coverage I've been working on, I got an email from Tony saying he saw my YouTube video. And we've been corresponding back and forth a little bit. And so I asked him if he would be willing to chat, and he's been very nice. So we scheduled a Zoom call. And at the time that I'm recording this episode, I have not talked to him yet. Today is a Tuesday. We are talking this Thursday. So I'm not quite sure how the transitions are going to be. I apologize if they're a little bit choppy, but I'm going to be splicing in that interview with him. And we'll also, you know, be getting into all the theories surrounding what could have happened to the five men in this episode. So let me know your thoughts, and I hope y'all enjoy. Trigger warning for today's episode. This podcast is adult. It is not for children. Listener discretion is advised, and all of the sources that were used for today's episode will be down in the show notes. So in Tony's book, Occam's Razor is specifically referenced, and it was interesting because when I was talking to my parents about this case, my dad specifically referenced Occam's Razor. So I wanted to start by just briefly summarizing for those of you who might not know what this is. So in my probably poorly explained words, just to summarize, Occam's Razor is this philosophical concept where when you're looking at a mystery, something unexplained, whatever seems most plausible or most likely to have happened is probably what happened. So Occam's Razor, depending on who you ask, you'll get a different answer when it comes to the Yuba County Five. Some people say you could use Occam's Razor and look at this case and see it's very obvious that Gary Matthias was involved in the men's disappearance, or there was foul play with him. But there's a lot of different opinions. So people who have used this principle will claim, you know, Gary Matthias had some sort of schizophrenic episode. But to me, these are the least likely theories. So we're going to talk about all the different like foul play theories that I could find first and get the Gary Matthias theory out of the way. But I said this in part 1, I personally do not think Matthias was involved, but let's talk about the theories. Gary Matthias being the foul play theory, we could point out that he had a criminal history. He had been in altercations with many people. And so people might, you know, question, is it possible someone at the Chico game or in Oroville, the town they stopped through on their way home, is it possible he upset someone at one of these locations, got into a fight, and this resulted in a street chase all the way up to the Plumas National Forest? Maybe the men didn't want to be followed home, so they took a sharp turn up there. And so it's not necessarily that Gary Mathias meant the boys harm, but maybe he upset someone and that led to them being chased up there. But there's also theories that he had some type of schizophrenic episode, but he hadn't had an episode in 2 years. He was on a strict regimen of medication. There was nothing reported by eyewitnesses at the Chico game that would point to like concerning behavior. Same thing with the Bears Market sightings, which were confirmed by at least two people that were at the store. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary for the men. So that doesn't really make sense in my opinion either. In the Yuba County's case files from 2019 to 2020, there are also two letters stating they believe Gary Mathias was a victim of foul play. So I think it's pretty interesting and telling that the department that did all the research for this case put everything together. Whether you believe the investigation was flawed or not, I do think it's telling that they're labeling Gary Mathias not as a suspect or a person of interest even, but a victim and a victim of foul play. Both of the letters from the Yuba County's case files also emphasized they are working Gary Mathias's disappearance as a missing persons slash homicide case. It's also been reported in the press that police believe some sort of foul play was involved, and a lot of the family members believe this as well. But with that being said, I don't want to be disrespectful because there are also family members who believe Gary Mathias was involved and this was some type of foul play. So maybe Gary Mathias snapped. Maybe he lured the men up to the mountains under false pretenses for whatever reason. But we should remember that Gary Mathias's criminal history was when he was not being properly medicated for his schizophrenia. And at the time he disappeared, he had been receiving mental health and psychiatric services for several years. He was a part of the Gateway Gators basketball team. He was working at his stepfather's business, so he was capable of, you know, holding down a job. He had a roof over his head. He had this group of friends he was spending a lot of time with. And when Gary's family was interviewed, they said he had been doing very well. Additionally, it is extremely rare for persons with schizophrenia to go on to commit violent crimes. In fact, statistically, it's far more common for persons with schizophrenia to be victims of violent crimes. Though there are some peculiar statements made by Gary's mother to police who stated Gary had to ask his stepfather's permission to go to bed, eat food, or bathe, so kind of strange, it doesn't seem like there was too much awry here. Gary's parents have made some contradictory statements, though. And again, I'm not saying any of this to be disrespectful. I'm literally just laying out everything I found about this case. I think it's important to be informed and you guys make, you know, the decisions that you want after you hear everything. But according to several sources I read, Gary's parents did make some somewhat contradictory statements, at times telling police and media that they were unaware of Gary planning to go to the Chico basketball game in the first place. And other times they told the media and told police that they were aware of the trip. Gary Mathias's stepfather has also talked to reporters and said that at one point, at least, he believed Gary Mathias would be found at the bottom of Lake Oroville. So I don't know why he would know or say that. I could definitely see why people would find that to be a strange statement to make. And Mathias, as I said, had a history of altercations with people. So one of the theories is, like I said, he got into a fight with someone and that fight ended up turning into a street chase and led up to the Plumas. There is a specific person that gets brought up quite a bit, and it is a man named Farron Delazier. I think I'm saying that right. It seems maybe French. I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong. But Farron, we'll just go by the first name, was married to Connie Hewitt. And Connie is Jackie Hewitt's sister. So according to Farron, he told the Yuba County Sheriff's Department that he and Gary Mathias had a physical altercation at a party not long before all the men disappeared. And according to Farron, the altercation seemed to come out of nowhere. It was like Gary was mad at him and he couldn't figure out why or what happened. But Mathias would punch Farron in the face, and Farron then fought back, striking Gary Mathias several times before some onlookers at the party would break it all up. And an acquaintance of Farron also claimed that Gary Mathias was in a similar fight a month or two before he went missing with another individual at the party. The Delazier family had been known to be tough, and people around town knew not to mess with them. So, you know, question here, could the fight with Farron Delazier had fueled some sort of hatred towards Gary Mathias? Could he have wanted revenge? Could he have rounded up some friends and maybe they heard about the men being out away from their hometown so he knew they could be more vulnerable out there? Could they have heard about the men's trip to Chico and seen this as an opportunity, basically? There are rumors of some type of confrontation also involving the five men on the night of their disappearance with an unknown group of individuals outside of Bear's Market. But these are just rumors as far as I know. It doesn't sound like there were specific witnesses or people who worked at the store who actually saw this. So it could just be town gossip, but maybe the fight led to road rage and the people that were at Bear's Market tailed them up into the Plumas, and then the men were too scared to come back down and they ended up succumbing to the elements. There's also a pretty popular theory that whoever sought the men harm was after Gary Mathias and the other four just got caught in the crosshairs. A common rumor is that Mathias was actually thrown over the Oroville Dam and drowned. So there was some type of altercation in Oroville. Whoever was involved grabbed Gary Mathias, threw him over the Oroville Dam. He drowned, and it scared the other men so badly that they tried to lose the car and went up into the Plumas. Something like that. Some say in this theory that a man named Alan Martin was involved. A couple months after the bodies had been found, Alan Martin is said to have stopped by Gary Mathias's residence. And apparently, Alan Martin told the family he had been out with a group of friends on the night that the Yuba County Five vanished. The group stopped the men on a bridge near Oroville Dam, and one of the men started physically assaulting and bullying Jackie Hewitt. According to Alan, this angered Mathias, who attempted to defend Jackie, and the rest of the group that was with Alan jumped Gary Mathias. Alan Martin, though, did not say anything about throwing Mathias over the bridge or murdering him. And according to the family that recalls this conversation, he just says they got in like a physical altercation. Also, according to Alan, a man named Glenn Baker, after the altercation, then drove Jack Madruga's car up to the mountains and left it there. The boys were all inside the car when this Glenn Baker guy was driving it, and then Glenn Baker or Alan, somebody, then ordered the men to get out of the car, and terrified, they took off running into the freezing woods. It could also be possible the men ran terrified into the woods because they had witnessed Gary Mathias being murdered. But this is all, of course, speculation. Everything that I am saying is speculation, all alleged. And largely, this is because Gary Mathias has never been found, never found his body. And the only physical evidence we found that he was up in the Plumas were his shoes in the cabin where Ted Weir's body was found. There were also some handwritten notes found in the trailer that seemingly belonged to Gary Mathias. Part of Gary Mathias's mental health treatment that he had been receiving was if he was having like a bad day or he was struggling, his doctor would tell him to write down different affirmations and kind of journal. And it seems like these little writings that were found in the cabin were Gary Mathias's affirmations. Alan Martin also, interestingly and tragically, would later die from a heroin overdose. It also later came out that one of the men in the group that Alan Martin identified and told the family about was still a living person and still a person of interest in the case. And whoever this person was drove a red stepside pickup truck. So remember all of those sightings of a red or a rusty colored old pickup truck being with the men on the night that they disappeared. So not long after all of this, Alan Martin's overdose and everything, the man who owned the red truck allegedly also skipped town and he moved to Arizona. So talking about this red truck now and thinking back to something that one of the, can't remember who, but one of the psychics pointed out, you know, because they saw the red truck as well before this was in the papers. The psychic talked about a man in a cowboy hat and a woman with a baby. Were they in this red truck? Did these individuals, for some reason, lure the men up into the mountains under false pretenses, or were they having some type of trouble and the men agreed to help them out? If the sightings of the men at Mary's Country Store are true, it's possible whoever owned the red truck needed food, money, or ran into car trouble, and the men maybe bumped into them there and were willing to help, because at Mary's Country Store, there was allegedly a woman with a baby or someone who appeared to be a woman at the store, standing with all the men. In the Yuba County file, there's also a note stating Theron DeLazier, the one who got in the fight with Gary Mathias, owned a red pickup truck at one time during the early 1970s. So some might speculate this was Theron's truck, but again, this is just all alleged. So another foul play theory ties back to Gateway Projects. And remember all the fire attacks that we talked about in part one and the murder. Gateway Projects was designed to help those with intellectual disabilities and those with mental disorders and help them transition into society, hold down jobs. Non-intellectually disabled adults are at about a 5% risk of personal victimization, whereas intellectually disabled adults, people who were involved in Gateway Projects, for example, are at a 20% risk of personal victimization. The Yuba County Five were rubber stamped as being disabled, and they were members of this group. They made it known publicly into their community who they were, what they were about. And this group was clearly not liked by all, because as we discussed in part one, there was some type of hate group or person, individual, that was causing these horrible attacks. They were setting people's cars on fire that worked there. They were calling the Gateway Projects and making bomb threats. They were throwing Molotov cocktails, sometimes like in the warehouses. And then of course there's the unsolved murder of one of the men who like owned Gateway Projects. So is it possible that whoever was responsible for the terroristic threats on Gateway Projects saw the men on their way out to Chico, or saw them at the basketball game at Bears Market somewhere throughout the night and recognized them, maybe wanted to scare them? Is it possible someone from whatever this hate group was threatened them, forced them to hide in the Plumas, and then left the men too scared to come back down from the mountain. They basically forced them into hiding. Continuing to go through foul play theories, there is also, of course, someone else we have to talk about, and that is Joseph Shones. Joseph Shones had a very sketchy story, and he continued to change his story. And he is the last person, allegedly, who saw these men alive. He had a history, too, of illegally selling marijuana. Could Shones have been up there doing some type of illegal activity, and the men went up there to buy drugs? Or could they have been scared by someone up to the mountain or gone up there for another reason and ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time? Maybe Shones was doing some type of drug deal or sell, and the men didn't know they were walking right into their crosshairs. Joseph Shones' story about why he was up on the mountain that night changed multiple times, as well as his play-by-play of events. He has been known by pretty much everyone who knew him to be a liar, a drunk, someone who made up a lot of stories. He also got very defensive, and his behavior became weird when police tried to press him for more information about that night and what he remembered. The other big question is, why didn't he go straight from Mountain House, that place he walked down to from the Plumas, to the hospital if he was truly having a heart attack? And I'm also kind of confused by all of this because some of the sources I read like recently said that the doctors did confirm, though, that Shones had a heart attack. But then there's other sources that just say, we don't really know because the medical records were never released. So I'm still kind of confused about that. It's hard to know if he was having a heart attack when we don't really have the records. We also don't know if he had a heart attack in the timeline he's claiming, because like we do know he went from Mountain House home and then to the hospital in the span of like basically a full day. Like he let all this time pass and he never mentioned to all the people he was talking to that he was having a heart attack. So maybe the heart attack, if it did happen, came on after all of this happened, and he's just kind of using it as a cover for why he was up in the mountains in the first place. We do know that Shones also had some violent tendencies. He had a history of pulling his gun. He shot at his neighbor. We talked about that in part two. If Shones wasn't involved, could he have witnessed something on accident? Could there have been an altercation between some strangers and the five men, and that's why Shones was so upset in the hospital? Like, he just was in the wrong, like Shones was in the wrong place at the wrong time and saw something, and he's too scared to say what actually happened. There was also another key issue identified in Shones' story by Drew Beeson. This is another author. He wrote Out of Bounds, What Happened to the Yuba County Five. And according to Beeson, Shones claimed he stayed in his Volkswagen when he got stuck up in the Plumas, and he would stay in there trying to keep warm because it was freezing cold. But when Beeson looked into the make and model of Shone's car, he found it to be one of those cars that had to be in motion in order to produce heat. It operated on an air-cooled engine. So if Shone's timeline of events is true, he would have been up in the mountains and below freezing temperatures for 10 hours in a car that was not capable of keeping him warm. And according to him, the car was stationary. So he would have been in those conditions for 10 hours, and then he would have walked more than 8 miles in the freezing cold to get to Mountain House, all the while he's having a heart attack, mind you. So the entire story just doesn't seem possible, right? So to me, at the very least, Shones is not being honest about the night. And at the most, he was allegedly involved in what happened to the men. It's also been theorized that Shones got his car stuck up there deliberately in an attempt to have some sort of alibi after committing a crime near the area. Or perhaps he was just drunk in the wrong place at the wrong time, like I said, and he saw something he wasn't planning to see, made up this story, maybe made up the story in attempt to get the reward money. Who knows? Another theory could be that the men again, were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They came across drug dealers or violent people in the area. One man reported taking his motorcycle into this same area where the men disappeared, and that he was met by a truck stopped in the middle of the road. The driver had a gun and demanded to know what the man's business was there. And then he told him to go around, like turn around and go back home. There's also a theory the men were forced out of the car and up the mountain at gunpoint. According to Jack Hewitt Sr., he discovered 30-06 shells near the Montego the night that it was found. Of course, it's hard to say if those shells were just there because of someone out there hunting or if they had to do with the men. Maybe, like, we know the men weren't shot and killed, at least according to their autopsies. It looked like they had just succumbed to the elements and then been torn apart by animals, but maybe someone shot a gun to scare them and the shells were there. But there's no record of these shells or any proof in the case files, so we would just have to go off of Jack Hewitt Sr. and what he saw. Not saying he has any reason to make that up, but we also still don't know what the shells were there for. When you look into theories, you'll also come across a man named Todd Morgan, and the pickup truck reports, all those sightings, have also been linked to this man named Todd Morgan. So it gets really confusing because there's multiple people who have been tied to a pickup truck, but he's another one that comes up. And Todd Morgan, we do get false confessions all the time, but Morgan reportedly confessed in 1994 while he was at a church in Yuba City to a series of heinous crimes, including the deaths of, quote, not my words, 2 out of 7 retarded males in the hills about 17 years ago. So 17 years from 1994 would be right in that 1978 time frame when the men disappeared. But he also says 7 males, and obviously there were 5 of them. So, you know, it's possible he's talking about someone else, but, you know, could Todd Morgan have been involved? It is difficult, though, to link Todd Morgan to the truck and put him in the Plumas on the night that the men disappeared. There have also been rumors in the area that Todd Morgan was not only involved, but he didn't act alone, so he could have been with a group. But if he was involved, why? What was the motive? There's not been a way to definitively tie Todd Morgan, or anyone for that matter, to the men. There are theories that Morgan maybe got in a fight with Gary Mathias or one of the other men. There's a rumor that Morgan had been harassing women at Gateway Projects also, and that some of the 5 men knew about this and were making some comments around town about it, so maybe he wanted to silence them. Morgan was arrested numerous times after the 5 men disappeared, one of which was because he was involved in a shooting. He shot someone who was believed to be the owner of a red pickup truck. A parent of one of the 5 men also reportedly received a confession letter in their mailbox. The person who wrote the letter claimed they were in the pickup truck on the night in question and had witnessed what had happened. It's also been alleged the author of the letter was getting ready to talk to police about what they knew when they allegedly died from an overdose. Kind of like what happened with Alan Martin. One of the other things I found was there was also this post online that had been posted by someone named Jessica. The post was then circulated all around, and Jessica is a woman that claims to be a relative of Gary Mathias. And at the time, that was just her claiming and speculating, but apparently it was confirmed that Jessica is in fact a living relative of Gary Mathias. And so she wrote this blog post essentially, and she said she believed a man that lived in the Marysville area, which is right by Yuba City, was responsible for what happened to the men. She also emphasized that the public intentionally had been given little information about the case. She also never revealed, though, who this mysterious man was from Marysville, but that could have been because she was scared and wanted to protect herself and her family. A crime blogger from Yuba City area would also respond to Jessica's post, alluding that they also knew who Jessica was talking about and that it was unsafe to reveal who this person was because they were still around and dangerous. But later, the author of Out of Bounds, Drew Beeson, contacted this crime blogger to ask some questions, and the blogger revealed the name of the man and went on to say that this man became a pastor and had a bad history with Gary Mathias. Apparently, this pastor guy in Marysville had made threats to Gary Mathias in the past. The man knew Mathias and his family very well and had an extensive criminal record involving drugs and violence. Kathy Madruga has also gone on record saying she knows who this person is, and Kathy feels that this person was very likely involved in what happened, but we still don't know who this person is. Kathy Madruga has also said many people knew about Mathias going to the basketball game that night, so this could have presented an opportunity for him to be targeted. David Hewitt has also confirmed he had heard of a local man who was a pastor that had it out for Mathias. So those are essentially all of the foul play theories. Let's see if Tony Wright had anything to say about these foul play theories. What do you think, again, all speculation, but like, what do you think are the chances that this was some type of foul play versus being an accident? Like, what does your gut tell you about what happened to the men?
A strong feeling of foul play, definitely. My feeling has always been something was going wrong that night. Whatever it is, we're not going to know, but I hope someone comes forward because in the past, 4 years of research, when you talk to people, and these are people who are not connected at all, that are not close friends or anything, they'll tell you about foul play theories and they'll tell you what they think. So the foul play is, it's first and foremost in my mind because there's no other way to really explain this.
I completely agree. I feel like after I looked at everything I did, my gut goes to foul play as well. Exactly. I think it's, and you brought up too, how the families and some people that worked close to the case came up with some interesting theories. And I mean, there were even some confessions allegedly of people who were involved. Alan Martin's confession to Mathias's family, apparently. Todd Morgan's confession in 1994 that could possibly be linked, how he said there were 2 out of 7 quote unquote retarded males that he had murdered. He had a criminal history. The pastor in Marysville gets brought up by a bunch of people. It's all really strange.
Yeah, and like I said, this is why I lean more towards foul play. You have all of this information that comes to you from people who aren't talking to each other. So if you have all of these foul play theories, and there's more people out there that wanted to talk about it but didn't want to talk about it, it gives you the impression, okay, something happened, but people don't want to talk about it. And at first, it was easy for me to say, oh, well, they probably had an incident with Gary. But then knowing the families and the, you know, knowing the five a little bit more, I don't think they would have put up with anything shenanigan wise from Gary in the car. Also, the more you hear about just all the strange things, all the sort of crazy, I guess you'd call bad actors in the area, as they would call them, just these crazy tough guys with bad reputations, it all just starts to build that case of foul play. But we're just missing so much information to connect point A to point B. Yeah, it's always like this threat that could have force them up that way.
Exactly.
Like threaten them, and they were probably trying to find another way home because they kind of felt like maybe they're being chased or harassed, and they knew their life was in danger. And from whatever happened, it could have been, I said this on another podcast, it could have been a chain reaction of unfortunate events. I don't buy the getting sugared up on chocolate milk and candy. I do believe there could have been a chain reaction of something bad went down that night, and it led to some things escalating and unfolding where it just got worse and worse and worse. And that's definitely a possibility. It's just getting back to that point of what was this like point of like ignition or whatever you want to call it, where, you know, everything just starts to unravel. And I think the root of all this is in Oroville. I don't think it's at Bear's Market in Chico. I think it's in Oroville. You either stop somewhere to use a restroom or a payphone or to get something, maybe food wise. Maybe someone was hungry and they thought, yeah, I don't want candy. Can you stop somewhere in Oroville? And if they stop somewhere and they ran into someone they knew or they had beef with, or they ran into someone in town who's kind of drunk and looking to fight people and seeing these guys had disabilities and maybe thought they were easy targets, I mean, that's a possibility too. And that's what I lean towards.
Do you have any theories about how long the men survived and like what their experience was like up there? Because Ted Weir, we know about how long he was alive for, but the other men, we obviously don't. They were badly decomposed. It seemed like their remains had been scattered by animals. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about that?
We know Ted made it to the trailer. And the discussion that I have with other Yuba County 5 researchers and with families is who made it to the trailer. Some people say all five got to the trailer because it would be uncharacteristic of these guys to leave someone behind. But some people say Ted, Jackie Hewitt, and Gary Mathias made it to the trailer while Bill Sterling and Jack Madruga fell behind. And there could have been some sort of discussion of from Madruga and Sterling kind of assuring them, we'll meet you. We'll meet you. Just move ahead. Just move ahead. And I kind of flip-flop on that, like how many of them made it. But I definitely know Jackie Hewitt, Ted Weir, and Gary Mathias made it to the trailer. It would be incredibly out of character for Ted Weir to leave Jackie Hewitt behind. Of all the people for him to leave behind, Jackie Hewitt would not make any sense. So what would happen, in my opinion, was they get to the trailer, and I believe Gary thought, I don't have medication. I could be in a lot of trouble. I need to go get help. Gary leaves and vanishes off the face of the earth. And his remains are somewhere in the Plumas. I don't know where we don't know where they are. It's over 1 million acres of land. And there's just some parts of that area that are just inaccessible, that are just treacherous to get through. And that's where his remains could be. Jackie Hewitt probably stayed with Ted until he died and decided to go out and get help himself, and he perished. But Sterling and Madruga, I kind of flip-flop, like maybe they perished on the way to the trailer. Maybe they got to the trailer, they let Gary leave, and then Madruga and Sterling said, Gary's been gone too long. This doesn't make any sense. We're going to go now. And then they perish, probably trying to walk back to the car. And then Jackie's the last one to leave after Ted dies, or maybe he's in a point where Jackie realizes he's got to go get help, because his remains were the only ones that, as gruesome as it sounds, were intact. And it's an actual body that they were able to do an autopsy on. He had pulmonary edema, which was like this buildup of fluid in the lungs, if I'm not mistaken. He was badly frostbitten. There was blood poisoning. I don't know if it was gangrene or something, but it was something super serious where Ted was in a bad, bad place. And I think Jackie may have decided it was time for him to go get help. And he tried going out into the elements. So it's all part of this big mystery that people have been fascinated by and are upset by and want answers, just for the families.
I don't know why I didn't think about, I have heard from a couple of people about Jackie Hewitt making it to the cabin, being there with Ted. I hadn't really fully thought about it before until you put it in that way of like, they were attached at the hip. Like,
oh yeah,
they would not have left each other. So it's sad and scary though, just imagining them up there together. And having to experience that. It also makes me feel like since Ted was found so badly frostbitten and, you know, so ill, that again, as gruesome as it is, I feel like unfortunately the other men would have been found very similarly had their bodies been more intact. That's my thought, because they were all in the same elements. So now let's get into the other side of these theories, that this could have been some kind of accident. So a big theory is that the men got lost. Perhaps they were excited from winning the game. They were chattering in the car, not really paying attention. And this led Madruga, the driver, to get distracted. Maybe one of them needed to use the restroom, and Madruga or someone else thought that they knew of a place to stop in town, but they got lost. Or maybe the men had a run-in with someone in town, and Madruga tried to lose whoever was pursuing them, and this led them to get lost, take a wrong turn. The route that the men took from Chico to the area where they were found in the Plumas near Roger's cow camp is not a straight shot, though. They would have had to have intentionally, pretty much, exited the highway and drove into Oroville. They would have had to have crossed Bidwell Bar Bridge and drove into the Plumas in very rough roads. It would have been very obvious that they were in the forest. The men would have had to have made so many wrong turns. So it's almost impossible, in my opinion, that they intentionally got lost, or that they unintentionally got lost. But that's my opinion. Because again, the drive from Chico to their home was a drive that they had made before, and it was literally a straight shot. So my only thought with this theory is maybe they had to take an unexpected detour into Oroville. Someone had to go to the restroom, or they got into some type of altercation there. And then they, because that area of the route was unfamiliar, took a wrong turn and got lost trying to get back onto the highway home. But the men also did not have any known history or incidents of getting lost while driving. And again, this was a drive they had taken before. But maps of Bill Sterling's were found. Maps of California were found in Doc Madruga's car in the front seat, open. So some of the theories are they got lost and they're pulling out these maps trying to figure out how to get back home. Another theory when it comes to accidents is Gary Mathias was having some type of psychosis, so he didn't intentionally lead the men in the wrong direction. Maybe he accidentally did. So it may be possible Mathias led them into the mountains because he was hallucinating or having some type of delusion. So he convinced the men to go up there for whatever reason. There's also some theories because Gary Mathias had friends in Forbestown that Gary Mathias was trying to get the men to take a detour and go to Forbestown. And he convinced Madruga somehow to drive there. And maybe they got lost along the way. But Madruga was very careful with his car. He was not known to be fond of backseat drivers. All of the men were also very fixated on routines, and they had very important plans to look forward to the next morning. So I don't really foresee a situation, knowing everything I know about this case, to think that Gary Mathias could have like lured these men up to the mountains. I feel like their safety had to have been in danger for them to have veered off of course like that. It just doesn't make sense to me that they would willingly do that. But with all of that said, there are still theories about them getting lost. And then there's also some theories about misadventure. According to the misadventure theory, the men went up there to celebrate or to hang out for a while, and then they got lost. Maybe the men were stressed about the big game the next morning, and they just didn't want to deal with the stress. They wanted to blow off some steam. They wanted to run away for a while. Some of the men did have a history, like Gary Mathias and, sorry if I'm remembering this wrong, but I think Bill Sterling had a history of running away. But all of that was a long time ago. I'm not saying I agree with this theory. The men were sighted as well, allegedly, at Mary's Country Store after the night they disappeared, indicating they may have been hiding out in the area, living off of food they were gathering from the area. So this could have all been some type of misadventure. And regarding the accident theories, let's see what Tony Wright has to say.
An accident, I don't buy it, because when you drive through Oroville, when you get on the Oroville Quincy Highway, you have a ton of opportunities to turn around, to head back towards Highway 70, which would have taken them home. For whatever reason, they just kept going into the north, northish. No, not north. Yeah, it was north, into the Plumas. It just doesn't make any sense. Getting lost, you've got opportunities to turn around. You've got opportunities to find a payphone. You've got opportunities to stop and knock on the door, because there are people who live in the Plumas, and there was Mountain House. If they passed it, it could have been open. They could have gone in there to ask for help with directions, and someone could have said, hey, you guys need to turn around and head south down the road you came up on. And also, they're not one for the dark. They're not one for the snow and cold. They're not one for taking joyrides or anything like that. So nothing with this is making any sense whatsoever. It's super strange.
Any final thoughts or final just comments? If you want to talk about your book too.
Yeah, I mean, Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of Yuba County 5 is available through Amazon. You can get it through Barnes & Noble. Some libraries have it. I don't know where people live who are going to be watching this, but definitely Amazon is the place to get the book. There's a Kindle version. You can get the paperback edition as well. And we're talking about doing an audio version of the book, which is the next big step in our project. I'll be going to CrimeCon in Nashville, which is end of May, beginning of June. So I'll be in Nashville.
I know some people that are going to that. That's cool.
Very cool. I hope to meet people who are interested in the case and know more. I'll be selling my book there, signing copies. Doing some like library speaking tours, and I would say a tour, but library speaking dates that I have lined up. We'll be presenting the book and reaching out to other people like yourself in true crime, just, you know, saying thank you for all the work you've done. And I know one family definitely had a great comment for you. So that was wonderful.
Yes.
Seeing that.
That meant a lot. Thank you for telling me who that was, because I didn't know. Yeah. It's just kind of an obscure username. And I did watch some YouTube videos before I started putting all my stuff together. And I think there was someone in the comments that was talking about how there are still family members that every time one of these videos comes out, they're watching it. So
there's a watchful eye. There's more than one watchful eye.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of that ethical point I was talking about, where it's like, you don't know who's watching these things. It's important that you talk about them in a respectful way. I feel like that's common sense, and like, make sure you know what you're talking about. But, you know, easier said than done for some people. But all of that to say, you know, family members that have listened and watched and tuned in, please let me know what your thoughts are, how you feel, if there's anything I missed or you feel I got wrong, anything I left out. I'm all ears, and I appreciate you listening.
I'm out on social media, you know, on Twitter, Tony Doug Wright, Instagram, Tony Wright Author.
Well, thank you, everybody. Tony Wright, author of Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five. This is a very special guest. Outside of like other podcasters, you are my first like kind of expert to have, you know? So thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
So we will likely never know what happened to these five men on the night of February 24th, 1978. It continues to stand as one of the most perplexing cases in American history. And I certainly have become very confused. The more I have learned about it, I continue to be perplexed. And that is the deep dive, the conclusion of this three-part coverage of the Yuba County Five case. I hope you guys enjoyed this big deep dive. If you did, be sure to let me know. If you're watching on YouTube, drop a comment down below. If you're listening on Spotify, you can comment on this exact episode, or you can always email me, shoot me a DM on Instagram. And if you enjoyed, I would love it so much if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, if you drop a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. On Apple, you can write reviews. You could leave a review like this one. This is from Wine Time, who says, "Love it. Enjoy listening to Perplexity. Kadra is a great storyteller." Thank you. Each time you guys leave reviews, it boosts me up the charts, and that is really the only way that I get new listeners, that and word of mouth. So thank you in advance for that. Thank you again to Scott, a patron, for requesting that I cover this. And that is another benefit of joining the Perplexed Society, joining the Patreon. And when you make requests as a patron, it gets moved to the front of the queue. There's also a lot of exclusive bonus content on there, and as I do not qualify for any type of ad revenue or monetization, that is the best way to financially support me. So that is much appreciated. That helps me pay for this equipment, continue to bring you guys episodes. That would help me pay for the Zoom membership I have to pay for every year to do these interviews like I did with Tony. So if you decide to join the Patreon, I would love to have you there, and you will get to enjoy a lot of bonus content. Last thing I want to remind everybody about is in 2024, I will be doing a live Q&A. I have not decided the date yet, but I am compiling questions from you guys. So ask me anything. Let me know what you want to know. You can send those questions literally wherever you are listening to this, whatever's the most convenient for you. I will compile them and I'll be happy to answer those questions for you in the live Q&A. Other ways to support me, like my merch links and my Buy Me a Coffee link, are down in the episode description. So check that out if you want to support. And that wraps up today's episode. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week and stay safe. And thank you again to Tony Wright for letting me interview you for this episode. I will talk to you all soon. Bye.
We are the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes like serial killers and the random one-off murder. We will tell you about bizarre occurrences like alien abductions and monsters in the dark. And we just might get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories.
At the very end of every show, we like to lighten things up and cleanse the palate from the tragic and terrifying stories. So we end our time with a chaser. You might get to hear crazy stories about our pets or just silly movie recommendations.
Give us a listen. We are the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast.
Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast, hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brennan. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leaving a 5-star review. It helps the show more than you know. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And if you have a story to share or a topic request, send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Kadra would love to read your story on the podcast. Until next week, stay curious. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast, hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brennan. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leaving a 5-star review. It helps the show more than you know. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And if you have a story to share or a topic request, send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Kadra would love to read your story on the podcast. Until next week, stay curious.